You're listening to Culture and Ecology, stories from the Confluence, hosted by Chelsea Peel and Rick Rolfe. For more information, check out our websites and join us on Patreon. Get in the know, stay in the flow.
Reciprocity is integral to the resilience of cultural and ecological systems. Ironically, sometimes using a natural resource is the best way to ensure its conservation. If we look closely at symbiotic relations between humans, flora, and fauna, we see how dependence on natural resources is a major incentive to care for them.
In this podcast, we speak with Marty St. Louis about his experience stewarding the Summer Lake Wildlife Management Area. We look at how wildlife habitat is generated and maintained with the support of hunters and birdwatchers, along with conservation groups such as Ducks Unlimited.
Last weekend, we had a report of people shooting out here. You know, at this time of the year, hunting's not allowed. Or, you know, shooting, just charging firearms at all and stuff. And so that's of concern. And, it was a bird watcher from Bend who I knew. He sent me a text that said, hey, you know, over the weekend out at the River Ranch barn, you know, I heard some shots fired out there. And so I thought the worst, you know, okay, what might they be doing? What might they be shooting at or anything like that? And my first thought is, well, the owls. And so I came out here to check it out. And the male, he was sitting right up here, kind of where he does. And when I walked over to check up to make sure the female was still on her nest in the barn, he pops his beak at you. And usually when I open the door to go in the machine shed, the female takes off. She flies out. There's a hole on the west side of it and stuff. That's how she gets in and out of it. And there's like a little bit of a loft up there. And that's where she's successfully nested there, oh, 4 or 5 years. Yeah. You know, when I first came here, there was a poplar tree out here, a Lombardy, right along the riverbank. And it had either a raven nest or a red-tailed hawk nest up there. And that's where they nested, and you could see them up there. It's pretty good. And then over the years, that tree got old, died, and fell over. And so there was a time period where they didn't nest at all. And, you know, they just kind of hung out around here. You could always see them. And then a raven came and built a stick nest in that large willow tree that's out there. And the ravens, they are not very tolerant of people. They like to keep their distance from them. So they gave up on trying to nest there. There was just enough people that were camping or bird watching. So, but they left this really splendid nest. So the owls took that over and nested there for, you know, seemed like 5 or 6 years. And then that nest finally fell apart and fell down. And then we're back to square one again. It's like, okay, you know, where's the owls? They're gone again. And I don't know how I wandered into it, but I walked into that machine shed, and there she was, kind of on that little loft up there. Owls don't build nests, so they just kind of find ledges, or they take it over from other things, you know, be it a raven or a red-tailed hawk or something like that. But she just kind of, you know, would arrange a few twigs and stuff like that up there, you know, and it was kind of a precarious setting and stuff. I don't think it's exactly level, so the eggs could have rolled or something. But then in last year, the ravens got in there ahead of time, and they actually started building a stick nest in that machine shed. They were packing sticks in there, and I went in there expecting to find the great horned owls. And I see all these sticks, and it's like, whoa, you know, what's going on here? This is unheard of for great horned owls. You know, this would be a really kind of a relevant, kind of fantastic scientific observation of an owl building a nest, you know. And so I asked a couple other experts and stuff, and They said, nah, I've never heard of that. Never heard of an owl doing anything like that.
Do the owls hire the ravens to build them nests?
Well, I don't know. I don't know how that part of it goes. But it took me a while to figure that out, that I hadn't seen any ravens around here. And so I'm seeing that. And finally, one time I pulled in here and there was a raven kind of out back here. Okay, that's nothing unusual. There's ravens all over the place. And then one time there was a raven close by, and then the light kind of went on a little bit. Well, maybe it is. And then we got the ultimate proof is I went back there one time and climbed up to look in the nest, and there were four raven eggs in there. And so that kind of settled that. Okay, no. Great horned owls still don't build nests or anything, so there's no great scientific revelation there or anything like that. But also, then there was enough visitor use out here that the ravens said enough's enough, and we're out of here.
Marty, could you tell us where we're at right now?
We're here at the River Ranch Barn on Summer Lake Wildlife Area. It was our last pretty major acquisition in 1970 that bought this ranch that came with this barn. It's an old wooden barn built in 1917. It is still in fairly good shape. It's being used, sessions like this annually. The local Ducks Unlimited committee holds their fundraising banquet here in this barn. We have had ODF&W regional meetings here in this barn. Kind of a odd type of use was Paisley High School had a prom here.
Nice.
In this barn. So we try and accommodate a lot of different uses. Yeah.
So what do you do out here at the wildlife management area?
I'm the right now the acting manager of Summer Lake Wildlife Area. I retired about 3 weeks ago, but came on in a temporary capacity to help with the transition for a new manager here at Summer Lake. I started my career here at Summer Lake in 1987, so it's been pretty much about a 33-year run here on this one place. Additionally, I'd worked for ODF&W another 7 years, I think it was 6 or 7 years.
So 33 years, what does your day-to-day look like out here? What were you up to?
Well, my role is the manager of the wildlife area, and what that entails is basically everything that takes place out here. From administration to daily project activities, special activities, monitoring events, wildlife monitoring. It's just a little bit of everything. I have a staff of two full-time employees, fish and wildlife technicians, as well as a 8-month seasonal technician that is here basically during the spring and into the fall seasons and stuff, working 8 months.
So who comes out here to a place like this?
Okay, Summer Lake Wildlife Area, so wildlife is the emphasis out here. We are the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, ODF&W, but this is the W side of things. This is the wildlife. There's other places that other wildlife areas that have fisheries issues or concerns on them, but Summer Lake is mainly devoted to wildlife. We are the first wildlife area, state wildlife area in Oregon, and the first one that has been funded with the Pittman-Robertson Act, or the PR Act, in the Pacific Northwest region. And so it's, as I mentioned, wildlife-based. And so depending on the time of the year, the wildlife area is a major area for hunters, and it's primarily for migratory birds. That was kind of the founding principle of the wildlife area back in 1944 as a habitat for migratory waterfowl as well as a public hunting area. Over time, it has morphed into more of a wildlife, well, in combination with hunting, a wildlife viewing area as well. Hunting seasons, basically you're looking at 5 months out of the year, and then the other 7 months, there is no hunting, no discharging of firearms, so it becomes a wildlife viewing area. And what we do is, of course, we host a very large population of migratory waterfowl that are coming all the way from Alaska or even Russia from the Arctic regions on their way south to wintering areas that could be as far south as Central America. The number of bird species predominantly is that what we are. Other wildlife areas are big game wildlife areas, but we're mainly a migratory bird.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about some of the restoration work that you're doing here and how that ties in with hunting and conservation?
Sure. The work done here, the wetland restoration, that's mainly what it is, but you've also got the adjacent uplands that are right next in close proximity to the wetlands. What we're looking at here is kind of filling in the needs, the life cycle needs of a wide variety of species. And it is a somewhat daunting task because, as I mentioned earlier, we have got migrants that are coming to us from the Arctic region that are just stopping here to refuel en route to their wintering areas. And so some of our restoration work may go towards the right food sources to supplement these birds as they're moving, you know, on both their migrations, be it fall heading to the wintering areas or in the springtime when they're moving back north to breeding areas. They need to have the resources provided by our wetlands to sustain them to be successful nesters or to survive the winter time period. So we've got, that is one example, but then we've also got residents here, resident species, that we supply breeding habitat for them. And sometimes the various intricate features, depending on which species groups or guilds you're looking at, have got different requirements in the habitat. And so our restoration work is kind of with that larger focus. We're trying to keep our eyes on the really big picture in, you know, and it's trying to keep all those things in the back of your mind because they're radically different. And this goes all the way down to, you know, some other species, say, just for example, a rail, a Virginia rail. They're going to like really dense tules. You know, you get to a point, though, it's too dense. And so some of our management may thin that out. But dense tules don't feed migrant tundra or trumpeter swans. They need more open water conditions. Dense tules are good spots for duck broods to hide or thinking about in the life cycle of a duck. Annually in June, July, they replace all their flight feathers that they utilize for their long migrations. They become flightless for a 6 to 8 week time period. They need places to hide, so that thick tules is a good spot for them to hide. But it's not good for feeding a lot of things. It doesn't grow some of the aquatic plants that come to the surface of our ponds that would then even be the basis or the foundation for nesting grebes or foresters' terns. And so we've got all these different thoughts going through our minds, as well as what our capabilities might be on the ground as far as water. Water basically dictates what sorts of vegetation we have out there, and control of water is critical. And so a lot of our restoration work is actually heavy construction out there, building dikes and levees, different sorts of water regulating devices out there to get these different features, habitat features.
Did you want to elaborate a little bit more on how hunting is actually contributing to wildlife habitat conservation?
Yes. Well, you know, kind of with what I just discussed about the restoration efforts and looking at the different nuances of, or the needs, life history needs of these various species, sometimes that entails pretty substantial areas. I mean, you can't do it on just a 1 acre. I know we're talking, you know, 1,000 acre units, you know, 2,000 acre units, a mile of dike, water control dike that might create a 400 acre pond. Those are big dollar items. And that's where the hunting community comes in. They have been right from the inception of the wildlife areas. The onset of things was because of hunters. That is the only reason this wildlife area is here. In 1937 was the Pittman-Robertson Act, named after two key senators. It was monumental in this country for wildlife conservation. It kind of created the North American model for wildlife management, which is basically kind of a user pay type system. If you want something, you know, there's a cost to provide that. And so this was just beautiful. It was an excise tax on firearms and ammunition used by hunters. It was a 13% excise tax, but for every, it had to be matched by states. That was the title of it. It was matching aid to restore states' habitats. And so a state has to put up a dollar, and then it is matched by $3 of these PR funds. And it's collected at the national level, and it's doled out back to the states based on a formula that has the number of hunters in the state and the size of the state. So you can, you know, be on somewhat equal footing. A state like Alaska doesn't have many people, but it's vast in size, you know. So if you just did it on acreage, yeah, they'd eat all the money up. But this was the way to make some sort of a balance. And then you have a smaller state, you know, say Pennsylvania, but they've got a huge number of hunters there. And so they kind of work on that formula. And so it is that funding source that started the first wildlife areas, and then it's been our continued source of funding up until the current times. Recently, there has been some attempts to pull in some other funding from non-consumptive groups, if you use, you know, want to use that word. A lot of people don't, but, you know, consumptive versus non-consumptive, hunting, non-hunting, you know, game, non-game type species that way. And so that's the role of hunters is, you know, they are sustaining a very big program out here that otherwise we just couldn't afford it. Some states are different, but in Oregon, the model is, you know, we are funded by the Wildlife Division, revenues from hunting licenses and tags matched with the PR funds. We get no tax dollars. So there's a lot of people that come to the wildlife area thinking, hey, this is ours. You know, we pay our taxes, so it's, you know, this is part of ours. You know, give us what we expect here. Well, it's not really the case. They're kind of riding on the coattails of what the hunters have provided.
What is your experience with the birders maybe supporting the work that you're doing or in participating in some way?
Well, I think that's pretty good because I'm a birder myself. That was just kind of an outcome coming out of college and such. I had some very, very intense professors there that were, you know, very keen birders, and it kind of stuck with me. And so it's been a passion of mine as well. I started out as a hunter, and I appreciated the other things. I would always see a lot out there. You know, growing up as a kid, I was ignorant as heck. I didn't know about anything, but go to college in wildlife and you start learning about that, and then you become a birder. And so that just kind of opened the door, made it very, very easy to kind of say to bridge the gap between, you know, hunting and non-hunting, because I myself was there. You know, I enjoyed both sides of it. I could see it, you know, from a seasonal standpoint, okay, in the fall and the early winter, you know, that's when you hunted. And then after that, you had the 7 months when it was the breeding season, the migration time periods, the appreciation of species that you knew were going to the Arctic. They'd just come from Central America to see that. So it's been pretty easy to go down that path. And then I've made a lot of contacts personally at the wildlife area, you know, seeing that, you know, we're going to continue to need that sort of support, a broader base support, than to have everything just shouldered on the hunting community. And so we need to kind of bridge that or pull it closer together so they can both sides can see kind of what the other is doing, contributing to that. I've taken it upon myself to actively involve the birding community, the non-consumptive community, with helping me out here on the wildlife area with some special surveys. We've always knew we had quite a breeding component here, but we wanted to quantify that. And so for the past 10 years, we've had an annual, it started out as a shorebird survey. We wanted to document how many shorebirds nested here on the wildlife area. We'd set it up to where we kind of make a weekend blitz where we get as many people as we can. We cover the entire area in that brief time period, because shorebirds have got a propensity to be very, very transitory, or they take advantage of conditions elsewhere. And so if you were to spread that out, shorebirds could be here for a short time period, but then, hey, through some intuitive process, they say, hey, it's better over at Abert. Let's head over there. And there's no way, you know, we could do everything across this entire part of the state simultaneously. And so we just tried to do a snapshot at Summer Lake, tried to do it at the same time periods. And then I kept track of the information or the data we kept on discrete management units here on the wildlife area that I prescribed when I developed the wildlife area's management plan. And we could use it for monitoring to see the responses of these species to some of our management actions. We talked a little bit about some of the restoration work. And so we could kind of pare that back. You know, we did a major restoration project in the Bullgate Refuge in 2014. We created, you know, 1,100 acres of really open condition habitats. The shorebirds hit it big time. And then over time, as succession takes place, it starts growing back. It's closing in. The shorebirds, you know, kind of aren't as interested in it as they were before. But meanwhile, we're back to another area, and we're doing the same thing over there that makes it attractive for the shorebirds to go to that area. And so we just kind of keep this thing moving around that way. Mother Nature would have done it the same way, but she thinks on long-term time scales. I mean, you could have open conditions out here, or, you know, proper management out here would be to dry this place up, hold it bone dry for 5 years to kind of take care of encroaching vegetation, to get nutrient cycling in your pond bottoms. But that's not what the public wants nowadays. There is an annual expectation of things. And so we're trying to mimic what Mother Nature does, but we do it on small scale areas. I say small scale, 1 to 2,000 acre units, and we just move them around. And so there'll be time periods where we've got 1,000 acres that looks like it's been affected by drought. Conversely, we've got other areas that look like they've been flooded out. That's Mother Nature. She'd have big time periods of huge floods. You'd lose a lot of habitat. There'd be a lot of species that wouldn't be able to take advantage of it. But then that might persist for 20 years, 50 years, 100 years. But we're doing it on a more kind of concise time period so we can kind of accommodate all these different species and their different life cycles and stuff. So someone can come here and see representative things, you know, maybe not in the full magnitude that you would, historically or naturally. You know, we are far from natural. Yeah.
Thank you so much for painting such a clear picture of what's going on out here. I'm hoping that you can take us home by telling us what happened to these owls.
The owls? I started the owl story.
Yes, you did.
And I left it off with the ravens that were nesting in there. And then the ravens, like I started to say, they didn't like the people activity out here, so they abandoned their nest. They just left. You know, they just said, no, we're going to cash in. We're gone. You know, I checked the nest again. The eggs are cold. They're dead. And so, you know, they're gone. But it was later in the springtime. What the owls left, or the ravens left when they abandoned it, was this very fine stick nest that now the owls will have for a long number of years. So they kind of set the stage to perpetuate the owls. And I think the owls will probably be a little more aggressive in defending that. I was quite surprised that the owls let the ravens take them over. But a raven is a pretty formidable adversary and such for a lot of species.
I thought of you as like providing hospitality to weary travelers and this like constantly sort of making sure that the hotel room is right for the right guests. And then the story of the raven and the owl and how there's this kind of fierce exchange for territory.
Oh yeah, there's trade-offs with everything that we do out there. You know, we make conscious decisions out there. We're going to do this on this unit and it's going to adversely affect some species this way, but it's going to beneficially affect other species in many, many other ways. But we also know it's going to come full circle. It'll work back and it'll slowly lose favor of the ones you intended to benefit first, and it'll come back to the other ones. So it's just this constant circle. You know, it's just kind of, you know, ecological succession on a much broader or quicker scale. And such, and we identify it out there, you know, what are our shortcomings in a unit? And we can see it. The birds tell us that, you know, quite a big part of our job, especially in the first 20, 25 years I was here, was basically just an inventory of what we had, what was going on, where things were, when were they there, things like that. We didn't have that before. I'm probably the first kind of more highly trained manager. I was the fourth manager of the wildlife area. And, you know, prior to that, it was basically the idea was, you know, good ranch or farm management was good wildlife management. And it largely is in a lot of cases, but the science evolved, the knowledge evolved a little bit. And so we started fine tuning a little better. Farming and ranching livestock are key roles being played here on the wildlife for delivering habitats for different species that we have out here and delivering a setting for the users to enjoy it. Cows, you know, through their grazing and stuff and trailing kind of make paths for hunters. They clear off vegetation. It makes it very attractive for large numbers of things like snow geese that stage here, that then become very apparent to viewers, bird watchers and such. In the springtime, we get lots and lots of calls. People want to come out here and see the tens of thousands of snow geese that are staging here on the wildlife area.
I wanted to ask you if there's anything that you want to share that we didn't ask that has been really important to you.
It's my vision that this place continues to support a lot of users out here, both sides, you know, hunting and birding, just to lend the importance of the place so it can perpetuate. I mean, that's it. For me, you know, this was never a job for me. This was just a way to live. You know, it's just something that was, you know, my dream as a kid would be to go out every day and work with wildlife, to do things that are good for wildlife.
Thank you so much, Marty.
And I just want to say thank you so much for your work out here and just being such a steward of the land and being really honest about what that looks like and acknowledging the difference between how Mother Nature would do it and then all of the pressures that are sort of on you to create this beautiful experience.
You're listening to Culture and Ecology, stories from the Confluence hosted by Chelsea Peel and Rick Rolfe. For more information, check out our websites and join us on Patreon. Get in the know, stay in the flow.